Names have a special power over us, our sense of identity. Sometimes that's a negative power and people are compelled to change their names. Sometimes the name of a loved one has magic and is recited over and over like a prayer. Novelist Anne Bernays and her husband, the biographer Justin Kaplan, have collaborated on a new book called The Language of Names. One of the chapters in their book is about married names. Anne was Anne Kaplan after they were married, and she took back her maiden name, Bernays, after she started writing.
When I got married, and that we're talking about the Middle Ages now, the goal, the end goal of every girl's life was marriage. I mean, it seemed as if life stopped there. That was it. You grew up in order to get married and have children. And I was no different from anybody else born in 1930. So when I got married, I was just so pleased to be Mrs. Kaplan. And then I started thinking, now, maybe I think I want to write something. Maybe I want to write some stories. Maybe I want to write a novel. And I published a first short story under the name Anne Kaplan. And then I decided, I'm not Anne Kaplan. I'm Anne Bernays. Anne Bernays is the person who was named when she was 2 days old, let's say, or maybe even before that. And suddenly to become a totally different identity, that is, Anne Kaplan. It just seemed wrong. Now, the funny part of it is that when we got married in 1954, it was just before the feminist movement, and a lot of marriages of people my age didn't survive through the feminist revolution, that is, of women feeling that they needed a very clear and stronger self-identity. And mine did survive. And maybe it's because I had gone back to my own name long before most people who got divorced. And I just decided I was Anne Bernays. And I think it gave me a kind of, it was like finding my sea legs in a way.
Justin Kaplan, how did you feel when your wife Anne reassumed her original name when she started writing? Did you take it personally? Were you offended?
Well, I suppose at first I was a little taken aback, as I think anyone at that period would have been. You begin to wonder, is there something wrong with me that I'm being rejected in favor of her maiden name? But after a little while, it began to make total sense to me, especially since it seemed silly to have two writers in the same family with the same name. We're different people, and I respected the difference, and I'm all in favor of it now.
So, Anne Bernays, when do you use the name Anne Kaplan?
When I go to the dentist.
when you're paying a bill?
When I'm paying a bill, all my paychecks come to Anne Kaplan because the Social Security Administration will not issue me a check under Anne Bernays, even though I've published 8 novels under that name and 2 nonfiction books and teach under that name. I cannot get, unless I go to court and have it legally changed back, I can't get my name, my real name, on a check.
Different religions and different ethnic groups have different approaches to naming children. You've done a lot of research for your book. Justin Kaplan, what are some of the things you learned about different traditions used for naming children?
Well, we did a fair amount of digging in anthropology and so-called primitive societies as well as American society. The range of practice is absolutely enormous. In some societies, the child's name is considered to be is an incantation, a sort of a magic formula, not to be shared with outsiders. In other societies, such as ours, infant naming is a public rite of passage, and the style is altogether different. Let's say between the white community and the black community. The white community tends to be fairly conservative and unimaginative in choosing names for children. If you look at the family of the novelist Henry James, you'll see that for 3 or 4 generations, the Jameses were named either Henry or William, which is terribly confusing. We've noticed very conspicuously that in the black community, there's a huge amount of imagination, invention, and variety. We found we were a printout of children's names from one zip code area in Chicago, and the number of unique names was very impressive. But by unique names, I mean a name that occurs only once, that was truly original, that may not have ever been heard before.
In some traditions, children are named as a way of paying tribute to the living. In other traditions, children are named as a way of paying tribute to the dead. What did you learn about that?
Tribute to the living, you can do it unless you're an Ashkenazi Jew. As a matter of fact, and there's one tradition which goes back a couple of centuries. It's called a gift name. And I think it started right after the slaves were freed. And that is that if somebody gave you something or did something for you or supported you or took you in or was kind in some extended way, you named your child after that person as a so-called gift name. And that really is lovely. If you're an Ashkenazi Jew, you cannot name your child after someone who is still alive, because it's bad. It's going to it may come back and haunt you, or it's bad luck.
Well, it's bad for a perfectly rational reason. The fear is that if a child is named after an older person and the older person dies, the angel of death may call at the wrong house.
And then there's also the tradition of good Catholic families of having to give their child the middle name of one saint. So that's why you see so many Catholic children or people who have recognizable saints' names. It's part of the ritual.
My guests are novelist Anne Bernays and biographer Justin Kaplan. They've collaborated on a new book called The Language of Names. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Anne Bernays and biographer Justin Kaplan, their new book, The Language of Names, examines how people are named and why names have so much power. Justin Kaplan, you wrote a biography of Mark Twain, whose real name was Samuel Clemens. Why did he change his name?
Well, but part of it had to do with the convention in the 19th century of humorists and entertainers taking pseudonyms. But in the case of Mark Twain, the change of name from the choice of the name Mark Twain was deeply organic and is part of his evolution from a sort of drifter journalist into someone who said that his vocation was to excite the laughter of God's creatures. And at the point at which Mark Twain decides that he's going to be a humorist and a writer is the point at which he discovers his new name and signs a travel letter to a Nevada paper. I feel as if I just awakened from a long sleep, and he signs it, "Yours dreamily, Mark Twain." And I think that's the first time that the name Mark Twain appeared in print. I was also fascinated by somewhat the same process with Walt Whitman, who started off as Walter Whitman Jr., and then when he discovers the personality and identity that he wanted to project in Leaves of Grass, he becomes the simple Walt.
Yeah, and I should mention you wrote a biography of Walt Whitman as well. And Anne Bernays, what turned you toward writing this book? What inspired you to do it?
Well, one of the things was my mother, who belonged to something called the Lucy Stone League, where women were determined to persuade other women to keep their names after marriage. At that point, I was very young and thought, what's the big deal here? And I realized later, much later, what the big deal was. So I had that, her kind of pioneering work in the names trade to think about. But also as a novelist, I was fascinated by how a fiction writer names his or her characters, how you know when it's right, how you know when it's wrong. You do, and you may not be able to articulate why you know it's wrong, but you have to go back and change it throughout the whole book. When you name a character, it's much more important than when you name a child, or it's much more complex, let's say, because when you name a child, what you're doing is sticking on that child, what you think you want that child to become. When you're naming a character, you have to get all the little currents, the cross currents, the undertones, the overtones, all the odor that rises off the name. And a name is a message to your readers. So I was fascinated by not only how fiction writers name their characters, but also where they get these names from. For instance, the novelist William Gaddis claims that he gets his names for characters off the name tags on the toll booth collectors. Well, that's all very well, but he's not going to name a character something he got off at the last tag he saw unless it somehow fits the character. And the biographer of Arthur Conan Doyle says that when Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes novels, knew he had it right was when it had a certain sound to it, a ring, or like a key going into the door and clicking in the right way. And it's a wonderful sort of complicated emotional process that you go through.
You've both taught university level. Do you like your students to call you by your last name, by your first name? Do they call you professor?
Well, here we differ on this. Annie prefers the first name basis with her students. I still think that it's somewhat important for students to realize that there's a difference between the faculty and the student body. And I think that difference ought to be commemorated in the way people are addressed.
And I'm always embarrassed when my students come up and say, "Hi, Professor Bernays." I sort of look over my shoulder for somebody else. It doesn't sit right with me. But we do differ on this.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Anne Bernays and Justin Kaplan have a new book called The Language of Names.